On this episode of Baseball Barbacast, we react to the Atlanta Braves sweeping the Los Angeles Dodgers. What a performance from Chris Sale with the shutout on Thursday night. We marvel at the 37-year-old lefty's performance, throwing 100 miles an hour. Where did that come from? Then we welcome in special guest Jake Bauer, as one of the best hitters in baseball in 2026. Tells us about his breakout with the Milwaukee Brewers. And then, of course, it's Friday, so we give you the good, the bad, and the ugly. Let's get to it.
Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world that can't wait to see how good Chris Sale is once he gains a little bit of strength. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Jordan Schusterman. Once we get some meat on those bones, I mean, the sky's the limit for this kid.
Yeah, and you know, if he can really finally start to hone that changeup, I just watched and I think he could really use a third pitch. I don't know if he's going to be able to succeed at the highest level for a long time if he's just throwing the fastball and slider. Surely that's not going to work. Maybe as he moves into his 40s,
put him in the bullpen.
We will see those developments. Yeah, that's where Chris Sale belongs. On this Friday edition of Baseball Barbacast, a special guest coming up later. You may have already watched our conversation with Jake Bauer's Brewers breakout slugger. We put that up on YouTube early. If you're not subscribed to the Yahoo Sports MLB YouTube channel, make sure you do so. But you will hear that conversation with Jake Bauer's later. But Jake Mintz is here for now. That is what matters. We have a lot of Dodgers, a lot of Braves, a lot of Chris Sale, and of course it's Friday, the good, the bad, the ugly. But we are going to begin this podcast in Atlanta, Georgia.
Nine innings, five hits, no runs, no walks, 11 strikeouts, two hit by pitches for good measure. Chris Sale last night with the complete game shutty against the Los Angeles Dodgers to complete the sweep for the Atlanta Braves, going toe-to-toe against Yoshinobu Yamamoto, a pitching matchup to whet the senses. Drake Baldwin goes yard off Yamamoto on the very first pitch he throws. And then everyone said, that's enough runs. Lock it down. 1-0 win for the Braves. One of the most memorable regular season, non-no-hitter, perfect game pitching performances that I can remember for quite some time. And the reason for that, obviously, is the context. Chris Sale is a future Hall of Famer. The Los Angeles Dodgers are the Los Angeles Dodgers in town in Atlanta to complete the sweep. Going up against Yamamoto, the stage was set, and boy, oh boy, did Chris Sale deliver. It feels kind of overly dramatic and overwrought to say this. It felt like a Hall of Fame defining moment. It was, you know, earlier this season, Jordan, we talked about, did Jacob Mizorowski just win the Cy Young by beating the Dodgers? And like, yes and no. And the idea that the Dodgers are this litmus test is a little silly. But what Sale did last night for me was like, oh, no, that's a Hall of Famer right there.
Yeah, I mean, his whole Braves chapter has been just astonishing. You think about how we felt about him and how much more we thought we were going to see from him as his tenure wound down in Boston, and now here he is again. I mean, is he going to wow. So after last night, he has tied Christopher Sanchez in F-War, just 0.3 behind the Miz. So Chris Sale's in this thing. I don't think the Miz had a relative clunker last night at Citi Field. But what Chris Sale did last night, throwing 100 miles an hour for the first time in 8 years, giving a friend of the program, Wiley Ballard, a great answer on the post-game walk-off interview. Wiley's like, how did you do that? And he said, with my arm. I said, that's true.
Thank you, Chris.
True, Chris Sale.
Go off, Chris.
Those fastballs that he threw to Ohtani, he hits 100.1 in the third that Ohtani fouls off and strikes out on a slider. And then 2 innings later, he gets Ohtani to swing and miss on a pitch way above the zone at 99.6. Both of those pitches, his fastest pitches as a Brave. And yeah, to touch 100 on Statcast for the first time since 2018, speaks to how good he's feeling in general at age 37.
Yeah.
The juice that he had last night facing the Dodgers, going for the sweep, pitching at home, trying to make a statement in a 1-0 game, right? That adds to it too, because the you know you're going up against Yamamoto, the margin for error is so small. All of it came together to give us a really, really, really special performance. There's so many different directions we could go with Chris Sale here, and a lot to take away from the Braves in the series. But yeah, man, I mean, he is such an interesting character right now for another big reason that I wrote about last night that I'm not sure how much you've thought about. But what else does Sale kind of have you thinking about?
The throwing your hardest pitches against Ohtani is so funny to me, because if you sat Chris Sale down and you gave him truth serum, he would say, oh, no, I wasn't trying to throw harder against Ohtani. Like, he's just another guy. It's just another game. We're out here, you know, chipping away at the baseball factory. And now, obviously, that's not true, because the statistics say that Chris Sale threw his hardest pitch, you know, since 2018. Oh, it just happened to be against Ohtani. Like, sure, bro. I find that dynamic, and we see that a lot. Like, teams throw harder against the Yankees in Yankee Stadium, and they throw harder against Ohtani. And the idea that the setting juices people up, I find to be very reassuring because of how human it is. You and I, as people that cover the sport and write about it, are trying to like paste these larger narratives, and the players are so often trying to downplay those narratives. But I like that you can look at a stat, at a number, and you could say, oh no, Chris Sale was pretty juiced up in this particular moment. I want to talk about him in the context of the Cy Young race. He now has thrown 144 innings, 24 starts, a 2.06 earned run average. He has struck out 177 batters across those 144 innings. It's difficult to envision him. If the Miz, let me say it this way. If he beats the Miz, I think it will be because the Miz has a bad September more than Sale has a dynamite September. I just think that like both things kind of need to happen just because of where the Miz started from and the season he's put together and how hard he's throwing and how many batters he's striking out. But I think most interesting is like now we have a very obvious top three between Sale and Mizorowski and Christopher Sanchez.
Sanchez is not irrelevant here. I haven't looked or sketched it out. Could we get a Sale-Sanchez matchup in September? Those two teams still play seven more times, maybe even if they don't, you know, face off directly. But, of course, them pitching in the same series feels quite probable how they would line it up. I mean, what Sale's doing this year, strikeout rate over 30%, that's not new. Career low walk rate, right? I mean, 4.9% walk rate. But his command with this still ridiculous delivery and this ridiculous amount of movement that his pitches still have is so amazing and speaks to just how experienced he is and clearly that he's been able to really master this one-of-a-kind delivery.
I really think it is important to reemphasize how irrelevant of a character Chris Sale had become. So he's in Chicago with the White Sox and he's incredible. I mean, he puts together one of the greatest stretches of starting pitching in like the history of the sport, right? So from 2012, really through his first 2 years in Boston in 2018, he has a 2.91 ERA over seven seasons, striking out just a preposterous amount of hitters, nearly 11 strikeouts per nine. And he, you know, was sort of the first pitcher of this modern era to run strikeout rates like this. Like now we have Snell and we have Skeens and we have Mizorowski, but like Sale is the one who really took it to the next level. He goes to Boston on the free agent deal. And then in 2019, after they win the World Series in 2018, the injuries come calling. From 2019 until 2023, Chris Sale had a 4.16 ERA, averaging, this is the important part, averaging 74 innings a season over that 5-year stretch. He goes 147, doesn't play at all in 2020, had TJ, 42 innings in 21, 5 in 22, 102 in 23. And at this point, the Red Sox are looking to get out from a contract. That is how we thought about Chris Sale. An undesirable entity goes to Atlanta in exchange for Vaughn Grissom, straight up. And since joining the Braves in three seasons, he has just immediately recovered that peak form. 447 innings with a 2.23 ERA. He is striking out 11.4 batters per nine. So he is striking out more guys now as a member of the Braves than he was during his so-called peak back when he was with the White Sox and the Red Sox.
Yeah, and one, and I'm sure you just misspoke there, but I do think it's an important part of the conversation. The Red Sox probably get him in a trade initially, and then they sign him to an extension at the peak, right? He gets the last out of the World Series in 2018. He signs that huge extension right after that, and that's where the decline starts, the injuries start. And as you mentioned, they were trying to get off of that contract. The trade itself is one of the most impactful trades of the 21st century for what it did for Boston in those first 2 years. But the last Sale thing that I want to talk about, which I sort of mentioned in what I wrote last night, and then we can move on to bigger picture Braves and Dodgers stuff. Yes, this is only his third season, so maybe this isn't that big of a statement, but it's hard not for me to think about the fact that he has yet to make a postseason start with the Braves. For as amazing as he was in 2024, sorry for the Braves fans who were fired up listening to the first part of this podcast, let's remind everyone how that ended. With Chris Sale dealing with severe back spasms that took him out, that rendered him unavailable for that brief postseason run. And that was a shocking turn of events at the time. Now, was that Braves team, as flawed as it was, going to make some deep run with Sale? Who knows? But the point is that Chris Sale has not pitched in the postseason since 2021 for anybody. And now, and then last year, obviously, Chris Sale finished last season. He also dealt with injuries last year, but he finished last year strong and healthy. Braves not in the postseason. Now he has this opportunity and also this pressure, because the rest of the Braves rotation remains this enormous question mark. We know they didn't necessarily super strengthen it at the deadline. And so now I'm just thinking, I cannot wait to watch this guy in October. I hope that he can stay strong, stay durable, stay available.
Yeah.
He is just so unbelievably important. You could basically say he's the most important single pitcher for any single postseason team. I when you think about it that way, right? Because of just the gap over the next pitcher among real contenders. Maybe you can come up with some other candidates, but his starts are just going to be so crucial. And whether they happen at home, whether they happen, this is a good opportunity to now open it up to just where the Braves and Dodgers are now after this Braves sweep.
Well,
but that's what I was just thinking about, watching that postseason-esque performance against the Dodgers, against Yamamoto, and thinking that he hasn't done this yet for Atlanta in the postseason. He hasn't been in the postseason. We haven't seen peak Sale in the postseason in even longer, because 2021 was not really the same version.
Yeah.
So that's what had me really excited last night.
One last moment from last night. The theater of him coming back out for the ninth inning and the shot of his son in the stands, losing his cranium over the idea that his dad was emerging to throw the ninth, was so pure and so human and so relatable. It is one of the best dynamics in our sport. And we don't get it that often because of how pitchers are used. But when it does happen, the pitcher arriving is like the most WWE thing we have. And I think the starter coming back out is better than the reliever coming in. Like the theater of a reliever entering with the music and the lights is like, that is more like surface level, pretty cool. But if you know the context and the starter is coming back out, it's the best. I will now tell a quick story that Jordan and I talk about all the time. This is a little bit too niche, and I don't care. 2018, Jordan and I are watching the Division III Baseball Regional. Salisbury University, because we're losers. Salisbury University had this kid named Connor Reeves. Connor Reeves in this region, he was like one of the best pitchers in the country, D3. Connor Reeves comes back out to throw the 10th inning of a regional, And I just remember you and I, we might have been in the car, and we just lost it. The idea of a guy coming back out for the 10th inning is just like, is so inconceivable. And we now we say all the time, look who's coming back out. Connor Reeves.
But if you're going to bring me down the Connor Reeves road, we have to finish the story. Because the reason why that was so memorable is not just that Connor Reeves came back out for the 10th. It's that as they said it, this is a D3 regional broadcast. This is like a handheld camera taped to the fence behind home plate. And as the broadcaster says, Connor Reeves, the camera falls.
And is pointed and so- towards the sky. And you just see the top of like the grandstand. And the best is it was the drama of this kid like leaving his career out on this mound. And we can't even get the Connor Reeves bang. Well, thankfully, last night for Chris Sale, the camera didn't fall over. We got the shot of his kid.
And like Connor Reeves, who finished that game, complete game, 10 inning victory over St. Joseph's Long Island. Chris Sale also got the job done. Some kind of wacky drama replay, hit by pitch. I'm not going to go through that whole stuff. Laz Diaz being Laz Diaz in the top of the ninth, but it ended in the Braves fashion. And Chris Sale, what a freaking moment. So, all right. So Braves sweep the Dodgers. This series win for Atlanta is a big deal for a lot of reasons. When we talk about September schedule and what teams are fighting for, we know the Braves and the Dodgers are going to be in the postseason, but this push for these top two seeds in the National League is one of the biggest stories of September. The Braves securing the tiebreaker, which they did on Wednesday with Ha-Sung Kim's walk-off. The sweep was just great, was just gravy because they won the series in LA back in early May.
Yeah.
Is a pretty big deal if the Braves and Dodgers finish with the same record. And the Dodgers right now still have a one-game lead over Atlanta, but there's a good chance they'll be right in that same range. Then Atlanta will have the edge and maybe could force the Dodgers into a wild card series. That said, if you do look at the schedules, it is way more favorable for LA in September in terms of the path towards getting the best possible record. LA has the easiest record remaining in the National League by a lot, whereas both the Braves and Brewers still have these huge series coming up. 7 games left for Milwaukee against the Cubs, 7 games left for Atlanta against the Phillies. So the Braves are really going to have to earn it. They're going to have to earn this division crown. They're going to have to earn this top seed. But this is still a pretty huge deal to make this statement against the Dodgers at this stage.
And last year we had to pretend that the difference between the 2 and the 3 seed was important, where in reality you ended up getting to play the Reds in a scrimmage. Like the Dodgers just got to try some stuff in the playoffs against an just undermanned Reds team. That's not the case this year. Like, could the Dodgers or the Brewers or the Braves, smack around whoever gets the 6th seed, whether it's San Diego, Arizona, or Philly? Yeah, sure. It feels like there's going to be a bigger fight put up. If it's San Diego going into LA, you know they're going to have sauce. If it's the Phillies going into Atlanta, you know that's going to have sauce. And so no matter, like, the stakes of that feel higher than they did a year ago, and I think that's a good thing. Jordan, what else kind of impressed you about the Braves this series? The Dodgers will always downplay the significance of any given regular season game. That's just kind of how that operation works. What did the Braves do this week that was good?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, Drake Baldwin, like, he's special. Cooking again. First pitch splitter. I don't know. It was like right down the middle, but to take a first pitch splitter to the chop house off Yamamoto is pretty baller. Interested in just like Sean Murphy being back. He's a very odd character in this Braves season because of Drake Baldwin's emergence, but he got some time behind the plate. And then Ha-Sung Kim. What a thing. This guy had 5 hits all season before Wednesday's walk-off, where he was pinch hitting because the Braves had forfeited the DH. The Braves have been trying to figure out shortstop for years now since Dansby Swanson left. Of course, it was Orlando Arcia for a while. It was Nick Allen last year, who was a great defender and one of the worst hitters in baseball. And then since then, they've just been shuffling through all kinds of guys. Mauricio Dubon has done a pretty good job, all things considered. He's obviously still better suited for a utility role. Ha-Sung Kim, they claim him on...
They sent Jim Jarvis down.
I know. They just sent him down earlier this week. So Ha-Sung Kim, they claim him on waivers a year ago, and it seems like this kind of savvy solution where it was like, all right, sure, we'll pay. We're out of it. The Braves are out of it. They're like, maybe we can just get Ha-Sung Kim. He opts out. They pay him more to come back. He slips on ice in Korea, breaks his finger, and misses the first few months. And then he comes back, and he's the worst hitter in baseball and is essentially unplayable. He injures the same finger, misses another month. So now he's just this bizarre $20 million last resort bench guy. But they still don't really have a shortstop roster. Right, but they still don't really have a shortstop answer. And so the bar for Ha-Sung Kim to like get back in the mix here and be the shortstop is so low that he might do it. He might still be the starting shortstop when we get to the end of the season. So I don't know, man. The Kim thing, the Brave shortstop odyssey is so fascinating. Obviously, they got some other – Bryce Elder gave him another good start. The bullpen has generally been good. These are 3 one-run games. It's not like they dominated here. Sure. Chris Sale did his part, but these were 3 close victories. Still a lot to prove. Still a flawed roster. Acuna we're still waiting for. But that's why the fact that they were able to get these wins, however they did. Yeah, it was good.
He looked about as – he is an emotive cat. Always has been, always will be. At various points in the series, he looked about as like frustrated as I can remember. Like he was slamming stuff.
Oh, Acuna?
Like he was
talking about Acuna.
Yeah, like he was moping. He ends up going, I think, what, 2 for he has 2 hits in this. They're both singles, 2 for 12 with 2 walks. He had a weird misplay. Like he's still not right. And it's funny because I want to say this team can't win without him. Well, they did that one time. So they actually can. Jordan, here is a question that is irrelevant, and I'm mostly just asking because it's funny.
Okay.
If the Braves and Phillies tie, they play a 163, right? For the division or no?
No, we're done with those. I think we'd have...
No more 163?
We're going to have a lot of tiebreaker chat in September. Okay.
I was asking on behalf...
There's more complicated ones. Yeah.
Okay, so that's a bummer. I was asking on behalf of Jerks and Profar. Because it's a 162-game suspension. So I was thinking, could Jurickson and Profar come back for a 163?
I have not thought about him probably since the day after he was popped again.
Neither of the Braves.
Curious where he's at, literally, physically. Like, what's he up to? Team Curacao, by the way. Well, Team Curacao is about to compete in the Little League World Series. He totally blew it. Oh, my goodness. He would have been there with Ozzy in Williamsport this past weekend. The Curacao team is about to play Japan in the international championship tomorrow. And I guess Profar will be watching on TV.
I'm glad he didn't get to be around there because you can't have the kids around the steroid users. I mean, that's dangerous.
Very true. Okay, let's pivot to the Dodgers before we bring in our pal Jake Bowers. Big game tonight. Drew Anderson taking the bump, not traded, despite Jeff Passan telling us that he was going to get traded when we had him on.
Remember, we were joking. Yeah.
He was joking about giving Drew Anderson an all caps breaking when he got traded. Drew Anderson did not get traded by the Tigers. So he will take the mound on Friday against the mighty Dodgers. And who will he be facing? Let me just see. What is it?
Tariq.
Oh, there Tariq. He is. They're familiar with this guy. Here comes Tarek Skubal. As soon as we are done recording this, I will be hopping in my car and driving up to Detroit, Michigan to watch this series, to watch Tarek Skubal take on his old friends. And pretty excited about it. I think it's going to be really weird for a lot of reasons.
It's going to be so weird. It's going to be so weird.
I saw some Tigers fans being like, you know, I'm not like, don't boo. I would be floored if he gets booed. That would be one of the most shocking boos
that
I can remember.
Can't get booed.
Right? You can boo. If boo they every booed, other Dodger.
If he gets booed,
like, yeah.
If they boo Scooble, move this freaking franchise to Nashville. Like, we can't be doing that.
Yeah. So I'm any sort of buzz about boo, but at this point, like I'm having a tough time predicting boos. That's why I'm like getting out ahead of it. I'm assuming that's not going to happen. He should get a huge cheer. He should, like, that's fine. Anyway, so Scooble against his old team is really something. I like wonder, and I guess I could ask him this afterwards, depending on how it goes. It's funny that for all year we were talking about, okay, oh, Dodgers are going to do Scooble, Dodgers are going to do Scooble. I didn't really think about, like, I didn't look at the schedule and think, oh, the Dodgers are playing in Detroit not long after the deadline until after it happened.
That?
And I almost wonder if he was thinking, even if he was looking at the Brewers, like, I don't know if the Brewers are playing the Tigers I don't think they are, but how much Scooble thought about that? How quickly after he got traded to the Dodgers did he look at the schedule and be like, oh, man, I'm going to pitch there in a few weeks. So I'm curious about that. And the disappointing part about this is that the Tigers have really faded. I think when we looked at this on the schedule after it first happened, and the Tigers were still kind of having this resurgence, we were like, oh man, like that could really matter for both teams. The Tigers just lost a series to the Rays. They are really, now they're really hurt on the offensive side. They're just running out of gas. Their playoff odds have plummeted. So it doesn't feel as important. I also think that'll probably make it easier to just be like, all right, we're moving on. Let's cheer Tarek and just hopefully not embarrass ourselves against the Dodgers. But we'll see. We'll see. If they kick his ass, you know, if How You Lee takes him 4-30 to dead center, that'll be funny.
How
when
you
Max Clark
doing?
Against Scooble is fun. So we'll see how this goes. That's obviously the headliner going into this weekend. And then maybe Shohei Ohtani's going to pitch. That's another thing. Dave Roberts said he's going to throw a bullpen, I believe today, on Friday, to see whether he's ready to come back. But it does sound like he's going to rejoin the rotation pretty soon. That doesn't mean he's throwing six innings anytime soon, but they're going to start building him up in the majors, assuming his left knee and right bicep are feeling up to it. And that's a big deal. That's something, as we speculated, as it relates to NL MVP, as it relates to what he's going to be able to give them in October. All of those things are important for the most important player. So, if I get to see that on Sunday, that'd be a nice bonus. But what else are you thinking about if the Dodgers head to Detroit?
I'm most interested in how visibly affected Scooble is on the mound. I think he's the type of character where we'll see him emote, where we'll see him appreciate it. Does it change the way he pitches? Probably not. But that spectacle is so unique and going to be so sad. I think it's going to be sad for everyone, because now that Scooble is with the Death Star in the Evil Empire, it's easy to lump him in with like these sports villains. But what's important to remember is at the beginning of the season, I mean, Scooble was adamant, I don't want to be traded. Like, I want to win here. And him pitching in Detroit for the Dodgers is a recognition that it didn't work, that it didn't go to plan, that this was a missed opportunity and will forever be a missed opportunity. The Detroit Tigers had the best pitcher in the world on their team for 2.5 years and did not make it to an ALCS. And I think that that's kind of this heavy sense of disappointment. And that bums me out. I'm sure Tigers fans want to throw their, you know, phone over the border into Windsor listening to me. But I think that will be a very palpable feeling, and I'm curious to see how you take that in.
And that's why I am really curious about, like, logistically how the Tigers
choose to
acknowledge him. Well, that's there are a lot of other questions involving just like Scooble's experience. Did he fly ahead of the team a day or two ago, and like, has he been hanging out in Detroit the last 24 hours? I don't know. And Dave Roberts said this. Dave Roberts gave a quote when he confirmed that Scooble was starting on Friday. He said, I hope they do the festivities the night after we win on Friday so the emotion doesn't get to him and he can just kind of enjoy the welcome back. This is an interesting point, and I'm really curious about this, right? Like, can you play the welcome back Tarek Skubal as he's getting, as he's warming up? Probably not. So
why? Deal with it. You could play it whenever you want to play it.
Well, no, but I'm saying, do you do it? Is that like disrespectful? Are you trying to rattle him because he's the opponent? There's a lot of interesting parts. But if you're trying to honor him and you're trying to do Tarek Skubal a solid because you care about him and you like you want to give him the moment where he's just standing in the dugout and not thinking about pitching, that is probably better to do on Saturday. I don't know. I don't know how I would handle this. Like if I was the Tigers, it's an interesting discussion.
They should do it all 3 days. There are enough highlights.
That's true. That is definitely true. The other Dodgers news is that Roki Sasaki is hurt. He has a blister. This is significant just because for all the ridiculous ups and downs of Roki Sasaki, dude's been posting. He hasn't missed a start through the entire season. Him and Yamamoto are the only two guys that have made every start this year. And now he's going to miss some time. And blisters, you have no idea. Like, sometimes it's one start, and we'll see you soon. Sometimes it's just nagging. And this could just be a problem for him for the rest of the season, and we're really not going to know. His role in October was already something of an interesting debate, discussion. What is the best version of him? How does this get deployed? But now there's just an added layer of uncertainty for Roki.
I think it's a simpler problem than that. He was probably going to be their best right-handed reliever, with all due respect to Edgardo Henriquez, who has been like the most underrated Dodger all season long. Like, Roki was going to move to the bullpen, and this bullpen is incredibly left-handed heavy. And if you assume, and maybe it's not fair to assume, but like if Edwin Diaz is not Edwin Diaz, I mean, this was going to be their best righty in the pen. And now they don't have that. Yep. And I think against some teams, that is going to be important. Jordan, let's welcome in our pal, Jake Bowers, a gentleman that we have known for quite some time. We first met Jake in 2016 in a dugout in Montgomery, Alabama, when he was a member of the Tampa Bay Rays farm system. He has played for many teams since then. So have we. Jake is becoming, he has become a fascinating character of this season. Here we go. He is the best hitter on the best baseball team. Okay. The best team in the league. We're about to talk to their best hitter. Anything else you'd like to add?
Well, right. Objectively, that is true. You sort WRC plus qualified hitters, Yordan, Wilson Contreras, PCA, James Wood, Shohei Ohtani, Junior Caminero, Pete Alonso, our next guest, Jake Bowers. And that is the background of the conversation that I got to have with Jake on Thursday. Again, if you've already, maybe you've already watched it on YouTube, you can check it out on YouTube. On the Yahoo Sports MLB YouTube channel. But Jake was traveling for this. That's why he wasn't on that conversation. But hopefully
you enjoy. You can't have two Jakes in the same place.
We made sure to limit the Jake exposure for the everyone Jaclips. Involved. But shouts out to Jake Bowers for joining us. I know he's dealing with some injury issues right now. He will address those in our conversation as well. But we are going to take a quick break. When we return, you will hear that conversation with Mr. Bowers. And then we'll come back with the Bad, the Ugly. Welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. Jake Mintz is traveling, but I found another Jake to talk to. It's Jake Bowers of the Milwaukee Brewers, one of the biggest breakout stars of 2026. Jake Bowers, welcome to Baseball Barbacast.
Hey, appreciate it. Thanks for having me, man. New name, new sponsor, all that. You guys have come a long way, man.
Well, hey, look, both of us, right? But both of us have had several employers since we first met in Montgomery, Alabama in 2016. For sure. But here we are still playing ball, talking ball. How lucky are we? Jake, it has been so cool to watch your career unfold. Obviously, anyone that we meet and talk to in the minor leagues and see make it, it's like, all right, that's cool. Let's see how this goes. And for your journey in particular, I know a lot of people have become more familiar with you, but I think a good place to start, the numbers kind of speak for themselves. You can see everything that's kind of ticked up, but you just follow the trajectory of Jake Bowers. Seven different organizations, right? Since you were drafted by the Padres out of high school in 2013, I'm wondering, we can get into what has helped you get to this incredible breakout season. How nice has it just been to be in one place and really find a home with Milwaukee? How much has that really helped you unlock what you've really been able to do at the plate this season?
Yeah, it's been that's been a huge thing for me for sure. I think ever since I got here, they've really given me the space to kind of figure out who I am, not only as a player, but a person as well. Became a father with the Milwaukee Brewers, started a family with the Milwaukee Brewers. That's all my kids have known. It's been nice. My daughter loves Milwaukee, so it's all she can talk about. But they've been super welcoming to not only me, but also the family. So to be here for a third season has been, it's been a nice change for sure, as opposed to bouncing around the league a little bit.
I'm also, I was reading some of the interviews you were doing going into this season, because again, you've had some success already with the Brewers even before this season, some homers in the postseason. You really kind of made a role with the team. But you talked about it like coming into this year with another former podcast guest, Kurt Hogue, of course, who covers the Brewers very well before the season, how like you really saw this could be a breakout for you. It sounds like you referenced what's going on with you off the field, all the positive things in your life. Was there something that you had also figured out on the field that gave you that confidence to suddenly be a top 10 hitter in baseball? Or was it trusting that the mindset would kind of lead you to that kind of success?
Yeah, I mean, I think I had had enough success over the course of my career that I knew that this was not something that was unrealistic or out of the realm of possibility. Now, to this extent, I don't know that I could have foreseen it. Obviously, it's been quite the year, and it's been an adjustment to handling success just like it is handling failure. But I think towards the end of last year, there was a moment in Pittsburgh in either late August or early September. I don't remember exactly when it was, but I was DHing because Yelly's back was kind of flaring up and he needed a couple days. And I remember going up for my first at bat. I was fresh off the IL and I struck out, bad at bat. Look up at the scoreboard, it says like .185 or something like that. And I remember being in the tunnel by myself, like, what is this? Like, what is happening? And there was a moment down there by myself where like there was a second voice that popped into my head and it's like, it just get out of the way. Like, what are you doing? Just get out of the way. And so I said, you know what, my next at bat, I'm not thinking about anything. I'm just going to go see the ball. I'm going to hit the ball. Whatever happens is whatever happens, but it can't be worse than this. And I think the next at bat was an RBI single to either take the lead or tie the game. Get one more at bat in that game. Same thing, line drive up the middle, base hit. And I was like, it can't be this easy. Like this, that can't be the answer that I've been looking for however long. Right. Carried it through September, carried it through the postseason. And I'm like, it is like, that's the answer. And so just, that was the number one goal coming into the year was, just stay out of the way. Like, just do everything you can to keep yourself out of the way. I know that was a long winded answer. I'm sorry.
No,
it was a long, borderline like spiritual journey to the point where it was like, dude, you just have to stay out of the way.
But it's not long-winded. It's incredibly specific, because so often when we're watching, we're trying to look at the game logs and be like, okay, where is the moment where it changes? And I could have seen last year, yeah, you hadn't had much success for that a long stretch before that. You have two hits in all those games. You hit a home run. You carry it through there. But oftentimes you ask guys, you'd be like, oh, hey, was this the series? And they're like, I don't know. Like,
I can definitively say that was the series, because the next 2 days, same thing. We're waiting for the lineup to come out to see if Yelly can go. And it was like both the rest of the series, it was like an hour before the game, hey, Jake, you're DHing. Yelly can't go. And it was like three hits that night. Next day, same thing, another three hits. And I'm like, dude, like, and I remember almost being like frustrated with it, where it was like, you're kidding me, right? Like, like this can't be it. Like I said, and then, no, so sure enough, ever since then, I felt like I felt like I was 12 years old again, man. Like, in a way, it just simplified the game. It made everything so much easier. And I kind of just stopped giving the big leagues so much credit for being as hard as it is, if that makes sense.
So that's a really interesting way to, now let's go back a long ways, because I'm really curious about what it's like to, and you sort of referenced it, have the success. You mentioned dealing with the success more than you dealt with plenty of failure earlier in major league career. Mm-hmm. But obviously you got there to begin with because you were really good. You hit 500 in high school, right? There was a time, even in when we first met you 10 years ago, you were one of the top prospects in baseball. A lot of it because you were really young for every level. When I don't know if I've ever talked to you about this specifically, but this is a very big talking point now in the draft, is like guys who are 17 when they get drafted. And you were that. You were, I mean, 17 and a half. Like, you were one of the youngest players in your draft class. I bring that up because, like, there was a time, of course, as a prospect in high school when you were raking, you were slugging 500, you were doing all these things. Does the success that you're having now, you sort of reference, like, oh, it feels like I'm 12 again. Does it feel the same way? You're, of course, much older, much more mature. You've lived this whole life and been with all these teams, and now you're a father and all these things. But, like, does it feel kind of the same as when you were succeeding as a prospect in high school? What are the similarities and differences there?
I think it feels a lot different now as opposed to then. I think when I was 17, there was still an element of kind of riding the highs of everything. And maybe when you're a little bit younger, a little bit more naive, you're able to kind of like stay up there. But when you get to the big leagues and there's a lot of talented players here, and you're riding a high, it's pretty easy to come crashing down. And when you come crashing down and you don't know how to get back to neutral, you're kind of going to just keep riding that until you figure out that, like, this is not the way. And so a lot of this year has been trying not to ride a high as much as I've fought in the past riding those lows and trying to get out of that rut. So I kind of realized that, like, that middle neutral ground is really kind of where the magic happens. And it's trying to stay there regardless of what's happening.
I mentioned how for years and years, you're the youngest player on every team at every level, in the fall league and double A and high school, whatever. Listen, I'm not calling you old. I'm definitely not going to tell you that.
Fine. Because hey, I'll call myself old. Don't worry about it.
Hey, we're 1995 babies here, right? Like, we're getting used to all these, the Luis Laras and Jackson Churios coming up. But how has that impacted, like, your role on this team? You've seen some shit, man. You know, like, you maybe don't have the veteran level of Christian Yelich, but relative to this Milwaukee Brewers team, which has also been compared to like a college team, and Murph is a big part of that too. And I know you never played in college necessarily, but how has that impacted your perspective on this team, on the field, off the field?
Yeah, it's something that I think about quite a bit, as almost a responsibility to the team in a way. And being so young, I think that's something that it can't fall all on Yelich's shoulders, right? Like, to be the leader, to be, you know, the captain of the team, that's a big thing. That's a lot of responsibility, and it can't just be all on his shoulders. So I've realized that I got to take some kind of initiative, and I got to learn maybe not how to lead, but just how to set an example, how to be there for guys when they need it, how to notice things around me. But also, I think that's something that you have to have your head above water enough in this game to be able to look around you and see the way things work, to understand what your teammates need, what the team needs as a whole, and to be able to bring that to the table. You yourself have to be in a good enough place to do that. And so it's been fun for me to feel like I'm in a good enough place to be able to look around and learn more about the way the game works, the way our organization is run, and about what the team needs as far as how are we going to win games and how am I going to help other guys get to a place where they can help us win games. So it's been super fun for me this year for sure.
So I want to bring it into some more recent news, which is less exciting, of course, that you have been dealing with. I believe shin splints is what it's been described as. And I want you to give a quick update on that, and I'll explain why I'm bringing that up as part of the success that you've been having this season. But because it's timely, just talk a little bit about what you've been dealing with and how you, something that is not necessarily totally new.
Yeah. No, I've been playing through it for most of the year now. It's really not like a crazy thing. Once I get going, it's fine. But just like the day to day of jogging on and off the field, BP, ground balls, the whole thing, there's been times where it flares up, and just had a bad week where the workload was high and the symptoms flared up, and, you know, don't necessarily want to be in all of that pain for the rest of the way, but it's definitely something that I'll be pushing through for the rest of the year.
Obviously, it hasn't hampered you very much, and part of that is the numbers that you're having. I bring that up because, you know, this became a news nugget because a lot of people, when you weren't in the lineup in New York against the right-handed pitcher, everyone said, oh my gosh, he's not in a lineup against a right-handed pitcher. That must mean that he's dealing with something, and I guess that turned out to be true. But I bring that up because I saw that, and I was like, well, hold on a second. Jake Bowers is no platoon bat anymore. I mean, part of the reason why your numbers are which they are this season is that you've been crushing lefties. And that is something, of course, that has not been part of your success in the big leagues up until this year. What is the adjustment? Because you gave us that great answer earlier. Okay, this is where the mindset really shifts. And maybe that's part of this too. But how have you been able to, I know it's not a massive sample size, but it's over 100 plate appearances. You got an OPS over 900. What has allowed you to have that success and then, of course, earn the trust of the Brewers to play you against lefties?
Yeah, I think it's a couple things. One, getting the opportunity to do it has helped for sure. Anytime you get exposed to something, it's going to get more and more comfortable the more you see it. And then also just a simplified approach at the plate of I'm trying to see the ball and I'm trying to be tight to it and I'm trying to hit the inside half. Sometimes that can be more simple against a lefty. A lot of times it's a two-pitch mix where it's fastball and some kind of spin, as opposed to a righty where you could be facing four or five different pitches. So,
all kinds of directions.
Yeah. So depending on the lefty, obviously guys have sinkers. We just faced Martin Perez, who throws a lot of change-ups. Scooble throws a change-up. So there are certain cases where it's not that simple, but sometimes it's going to be fastball spin and you're really just waiting for something that you see good enough to pull the trigger on. So I really don't think it goes much deeper than that other than trying to see the ball and hit the inside half.
Was there a moment, you keep referencing how you think about that mindset shift to be like, oh my God, was it really this easy all along? And of course, maybe it isn't that simple, but as you've been having the success, I mean, was there, you mentioned kind of feeling that in spring training, but did you have to kind of have that prolonged success? Was there a point during this regular season where it was like, okay, not I've arrived. You've never really arrived. You're always going to have to be making those adjustments. But was there a moment this regular season where you feel like, all right, I've really gotten to a level here that I obviously hadn't as a major leaguer yet?
No, I don't necessarily think so. I think beyond the goal of kind of like I'm saying about staying neutral throughout the course of the season, something that came with that was just consistency, right? Like, I feel like over the course of my career, a lot of it has been like really good for a couple weeks and then really bad for a couple weeks and really good for a couple weeks and really bad. And so I just really wanted to be as consistent as possible. And I think as this has been pretty consistent, there's been a couple rough patches that I pulled myself out of fairly quickly. So no, I don't think there's any certain moment where something has felt different than another. I think it's really just been a day by day mentality. And that's kind of what's carried me.
All right. Well, you play for the Brewers, so I'm not doing my job if I don't ask about the big tall guy throwing 105.
Sure.
So I guess in your case, now that you've been there a few years,
You're traded to the Brewers after 23. I assume at that point you'd never heard of this kid unless you are a prospect dork like me. I guess he had appeared in the Futures game, I believe, that season. I think it was in 23. So the world had started to be like, okay, what's this guy with the long name and really skinny, really throwing hard? Did you face him in 2024 spring training? What was the reveal of the Miz to you with the Brewers and then, to where we are now?
Yeah. No, the first time I saw him was spring training last year.
Okay, last year.
I think that was his first big league camp. I think it was his first big league camp. He was still pretty wiry, couldn't throw a lot of strikes. And I remember in my head, I'm like, man, just tell this guy to get three outs. Go have him throw 105 for an inning and make him a closer, because there's no way he's going to be able to throw strikes.
That's what a lot of people thought.
Well, I mean, you just don't see it, right? It's pretty unique and it's pretty special. And then to see the jump that he took from the end of last season, where it was borderline not making the postseason roster, I feel like. I mean, I don't know the ins and outs of it, but to being the opening day starter and filling up the zone with 103 and, a couple secondary offerings that he's also throwing for strikes. It's been pretty wild to watch. It's also been wild to watch the mental growth and the maturity aspect of it. I don't necessarily think last year he realized how special his talent was. And I think he's kind of getting to a place this year where he kind of knows it. And so that's been pretty cool to see how he's kind of handled everything, and it's been fun to watch.
This is another kind of cliche question that I'm sure you've been asked about him, but also this is not something you actually get to experience very often because nobody's reaching base. But when you're playing first base for the few people that are getting on, and also what's the view there? Maybe you understand the extension, how far down he's getting the mound. What is the experience of actually playing behind him, to the side of him, and how people are, people are reaching base, are they excuse me?
Yeah. Everybody that gets on base is a little bit rattled by what the fastball looks like, I think. And
or maybe the next day, right? If you see in the series,
Everybody has something to say about it. And I think that's something that's cool about our game is in the middle of competition, this guy's blowing everybody's doors off, and guys that he's competing against are taking the time to say that's special, right? Yeah. In the heat of battle. And so that's pretty cool. Playing first base behind him, it can be borderline boring at times, where it's almost like he gets to 15 pitches in an inning and you're like, all right, what are we doing, man? This is taking way too long, dude. Let's wrap this up, but yeah. And then just seeing it from the side, I'm glad he's on our team. I'm glad I don't have to worry about it, game plan for it, whatever. I got a taste of it during our bye in the playoffs last year, where I got to face him a couple times. That wasn't fun, especially at I don't know what time it was. It had to be 11 in the morning, and nobody's on the field, nobody's in the stands, and this guy's just whizzing 100 right by you. You're like, I'm not mentally prepared for this right now. But super, super exciting guy to be on the field behind.
Now, that said, you and the Miz do have something in common, and that is that you have both gotten Aaron Judge out.
Yeah.
Jake Bowers, we will finish with this. Now, this is no longer really your problem because, you're slugging 500. You're one of the best hitters in the National League. And I don't think Murph's going to ask you to get up on the hill and take one for the team here.
Hey, you never know. You never know.
But maybe. And you're a team guy. So who's to say? That said, while I did know, I like asking guys who position player pitch, what that's like. 9 times is a lot of times. I mean, you really went out there.
It got up there quick, yeah.
You did, all with the Brewers, right? So none this season, of course. But as I mentioned, you did get Aaron Judge out. And that out was memorable. First of all, I don't know if you know this, probably doesn't surprise you. That's the hardest ball you've ever hit, ball you've ever allowed. the line out.
I'm not shocked. Yeah, not shocked. That.
Against Aaron Judge, a former teammate. Of course, you played with him mm-hmm. in 2023. But what's your just general position player pitching philosophy? When you first got called to do it, because you had never done it in the minor leagues, I don't know how much you pitched in high school or anything, but the first time you did it in 24, all the way to getting Aaron Judge out last year, you even notched a couple of strikeouts. I mean, mm-hmm. what's that been like? Not that you're hoping to do it any more time soon, but yeah.
So I might be a little sick in the head with this, but like when I get on the mound, I'm thinking about getting guys out. Like I want to get them out. I know obviously like, but like the way I think about it is like, all right, I'm going to run this fastball.
Oh, you're thinking sequencing. You're actually
how am I going to get this guy out?
That definitely makes you different. I do think.
And so like I said, I don't know, maybe I'm a little sick in the head, but I have like this little like air seam shifted cutter thing that like I'll throw up and in at like 75. Who knows if it's actually doing anything. And then I'll drop like a curveball off of that. But I'm not going to be the guy that's lobbing it at 40. Because I think
you were at the very beginning, you did have a couple like that. But
yeah, and I realized that wasn't going to work. I was like, okay. I have to throw this ball. Like, I have to throw it. And so I think that if I can throw a ball at like 75 and place it up and in, that like I can get a pop out. Because like it's tough. Like, it's tough to time up, especially something like that where you're like, I don't really want to go get it. Like I have to let it come to me, but then it's up and in and it's still like kind of flat. So like you also still kind of have to go. So I think it would surprise guys a little bit. And I think I got a lot of like foul ball pop-ups that way.
And that's what I didn't look your experience hitting against position players pitching. I guess I could have done that.
It's probably not very good.
Okay,
that's not a fun situation.
Of course, as you know, so you kind of feel like you have, that's like the reverse of what you said earlier about not giving big leaguers too much credit. You know, who's
got the pressure on them? I would rather face Miz than a position player. Let's put it that way.
That is a hot take, but I see what you're getting at. But hey, just credit to you. You got a couple strikeouts, an ERA of 4 in 9 innings, which is pretty good,
right?
And never allowed a homer. And just to bring it back to that Judge one, I know that's not a fond memory though. He had 3 homers already in that game. Mm-hmm. And when he came up, everyone's like, this is it. This is the 4 homer Judge game.
Yeah.
Jake Bauer said, not so fast.
So that was funny, man. That was funny. Cause he was walking to the plate and, we made eye contact before he stepped in the box. And I was like pointing at my ribs like this, like I was going to hit him in the ribs and then, dropped like a first pitch curveball on him. And I got him to like top spin it to the left fielder. And so that was pretty funny. I think I was the only one who got him out that day.
Yeah. Yeah. Top spin was key because 108 exit velo. Yeah. I mean,
I wasn't keeping it off the barrel. I was well aware that ball was getting barreled.
Hey, not a homer. That's all that counts. Jake Bowers, we hope to see you back on the field soon. This was an absolute pleasure. It's been so cool to see your career unfold and see what's next for you and the mighty Milwaukee Brewers. Thank you, sir. We'll do this again soon.
Yeah, appreciate it. Right back at you, man.
Welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. It is Friday, so it's time for the good, the bad, and the ugly. Get a start, Jordan. What's good for you?
A little bit of news that felt worth acknowledging. It's a good baseball player who's coming to the major leagues. His name is Walker Jenkins, who was finally called up by the Minnesota Twins. Will make his major league debut this weekend. And we talked about Max Clark when he came to the big leagues with the Detroit Tigers. I guess I'll be watching him against the Dodgers this weekend. Max Clark and Walker Jenkins were really just right alongside each other at the top of the 2023 high school class. And now Walker Jenkins, who has a very different
personality than Max Clark, but in some respects, a similar profile as a center fielder with, you know, plus really impressive contact skills. Walker Jenkins is a lot more low key. He is not as much of a Gen Z superstar the way that Max Clark is, from North Carolina. But Walker Jenkins is, I mean, this is a heck of a player. This is one of those guys when you would see him even in high school in the minors, and you're just like, I'm sorry, how old is this guy? Because he's built like he's been in the majors for half a decade, and he just kind of has the look. His minor league numbers have never like super jumped off the page until this month when he had like a 1300 OPS in AAA in August. And now I just am looking at the Twins lineup and I'm suddenly kind of digging it. I'm not saying this team's going to the postseason this year. They've got more prospects on the way. Vaughn Lacky, who they just drafted at the top. Emmanuel Rodriguez, if he can ever stay healthy. Rodriguez and Jenkins, sadly, Twins fans have heard this before, if they can stay healthy. Jenkins has missed a lot of time with a bunch of injuries, had some issues in high school that made some teams a little bit wary of picking him. But one of the better high school hitters we've had in the last 10 years. And yeah.
The Twins are like, oh, you ever been hurt? You ever been hurt? Come play for the Twins.
I think Vaughn Lackey's been shockingly durable. So I'm glad that he doesn't have that on his resume. But
it is unbelievable. The main characters, Royce Lewis, Byron Buxton, right, Brooks Lee, yep. Like they are
Correa,
building the house
of course,
out of
during his time. Oh, so yeah, but just the way like Brooks Lee kind of rejuvenate, Keyshaw has been on fire. And they, you know, I love Caitlin Culpepper. And so I don't really know what this Twins situation is. There's still a lot of questions about this franchise, but this was not a team I was tuning into recently, and kind of in the same way as the White Sox, who went from like a lineup that I was so uninterested in to now like, yeah, you got to tune in. You got to watch the White Sox. Look at all these fun hitters. Twins are starting to build something similar. So there you go. Walker Jenkins, welcome to the big leagues.
My good this week is the Tampa Bay. I can't believe I'm saying this. Is the Tampa Bay Rays stadium situation. Now, we could have a long debate about public money and whether it's smart to use to build baseball stadiums and other stadiums, and that's fine. And that's very, very valid. The amount of public money being used to potentially build this new Rays stadium is kind of a matter for debate, depending on what levers you pull and the way that the taxes work and the loans and blah, blah, blah. The reason this is good is that it is a step towards the end of having to talk about this and a step towards having a stadium that is not the Trop. Yesterday, the Tampa Bay City Council voted 4-3 to approve the Rays stadium deal. If the vote today, on Friday, from the Hillsborough County Commission, if they vote yes, the Rays will start building a stadium. Like they will start building a stadium. This plan, to my understanding, is the one near the football stadium, which is kind of close to the airport and the Yankee spring training complex. We have done renderings chat on here before. There has just been so much discourse for so long about getting the Rays a stadium, about whether it would work in St. Petersburg on that side of the bay or on the Tampa Bay side of the bay. And through it all, every time I go down there for spring training, Jordan, I'm just like reminded how much people there care about the Bucks and the Lightning. Mm-hmm. And the Lightning specifically to me. Like if the Tampa Bay Lightning were able to get a foothold in that market and matter to the people that live there, there is no reason that the Rays can't get to a similar level of impact. In some ways they have. I know the diehard fans love this team, and that is fair, and those fans deserve respect. But the numbers are smaller. There are fewer people at the Trop. They block off the upper deck more often than they don't. And I think if you build a stadium on the other side of the bay where more people live, that is going to be a good thing for this franchise moving forward. And so I am encouraged that this is going to happen. I think the new ownership group is Machiavellian enough in a productive way to get this across the finish line. Whereas I think the old ownership group, for as much as people that work for the Rays love Stu Sternberg, he might not have been the right character, clearly was not, to get the stadium built. So I think this feels like this is going to happen. Once we get the final you know, go ahead. We'll dig into some renderings and we can talk about it again. But yeah, this is good, I think.
Yeah, and the two things on this that people definitely need to understand, one of them you already hit on, which is that this being in Tampa and not St. Pete would obviously be a pretty massive deal for a lot of reasons.
I remember very vividly.
Yeah.
Before we'd ever been down there, sort of poo-pooing, oh, it's across the bay. Like, no, 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 no. Like, it is a different place.
It's a different place.
It is a very different place. And I did not appreciate it until I drove it. That's all. Please proceed.
The other thing that needs to be kind of hammered home here, the first is just timeline-wise, if this does go through, the plan that they've already started to propose, because the TROP lease runs out at the after the 2028 season, would be opening day 2029. That would be the goal. And then the real big picture thing to mention here is that if this does get settled and is like they have a plan moving forward to do it, just as we are pushing towards the Vegas A's, those are the situations that needed to be settled for Rob Manfred, the commissioner, to then start to finally seriously think about expansion. He has said that very publicly. We cannot move forward with any of those thoughts until we settle the Rays and A's stadium and location situations. And so if those things get achieved, that is where the expansion conversation can actually begin. Now, obviously, there's a much bigger conversation that is about to happen this offseason that is, well, before you get to expansion, but expansion could be a part of those conversations as well. And getting this Rays stadium thing done was essentially required before Manfred was going to take any expansion conversation seriously. So that is also why this is important, even if you are not a fan of Johnny DeLuca. All righty, let's go from good to bad. I've done AI slop on here before for bad, and we're going to do it again, folks. This was really something. Kalshi, the account for the Kalshi Sports, this has like 150,000 on followers on Instagram, posted a graphic titled Dodgers Lethal Rotation. Okay, great. We're just, look how good the Dodgers are. This photo is like, okay, there's Shohei Ohtani. It seems like Yoshinobu Yamamoto, but something seems slightly off. And then you look at the three other individuals in this photo and you realize that this is some of the most just, I don't even know how lazy or disconnected from the sport you have to be to post something like this, which involves three other humanoids that look nothing like the pitchers they're supposed to be, and be like, yep, there are the Dodgers. Now listen. If Kalshi Sports had just posted this, and I was like, that would be one thing. However, for them to post this on the same day that the Dodgers announced a multi-year partnership with Kalshi, literally hours after they announced this, this was in my inbox. Oh, Los Angeles Dodgers and Kalshi announced multi-year partnership. All right. Prediction market official. First federally regulated exchange in the United States allowed users to make live predictions and trades. Okay, whatever.
Oh, so cool. So it's so cool.
I just like, come on. I mean, it's like, how many different things are bad here? I don't even, it's hard to keep track.
You don't even have to say.
This post has been deleted, but it was up for quite some time. And it's just, it's pretty embarrassing for pretty much everybody involved. So, yep, just bad, 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 bad. What's your bad?
Kalshi using AI slop is just the epitome of the enshittification of our world. You know what I mean? Like, that sentence sucks.
I know. And again, I would not have bothered if I had not received the email hours earlier about the official partnership. Woohoo! All right. What's bad for you?
The Miami Marlins this week fired a bunch of their pro scouts. I tweeted about this. And I would say, I mean, it got more zest than I thought on the internet box. But the reason, let's define some terms, okay, before we really dig into this. So the way that scouting functions is there's really two main buckets, pro scouts and amateur scouts. Those terms do not necessarily define the level of scout. It's not like, oh, I'm good enough to be a scout, I'm a pro. Or I'm good enough to be a scout, I'm not good enough, I'm an amateur. It's who you're scouting. Pro scouts are scouting professional level players, whether that is in the minor leagues or the major leagues or in various foreign leagues. Amateur scouts are scouting amateur players. What the Marlins did this week was let go of 7 pro scouts in their department. My understanding is that all these folks were based stateside. They have retained 2 scouts down in the Dominican Republic to cover that league, presumably. And the reason that this is bad is it is just sort of another example of teams moving away from in-person scouting. I tweeted a graphic trying to sort of explain the differences in organizations. I went through every single media guide and asked around to try and get a firm number of how many pro scouts there are for each team. I think that my methodology, admittedly, was flawed. This is an imperfect science. It is a very difficult thing to nail down. I talked to a number of teams that were like, actually, we tried to do this. To get a head count from other orgs of like how many scouts teams have. And it's very difficult to do for a variety of reasons, because there are people that are in the office that are moving and then scouting, and you have different, you know, definitions and job titles and yada, yada, yada. What I do think is important to understand here is how large the gap is between the teams with the big pro scouting departments and the teams that don't really have one at all. So the teams at the top, pretty firmly, Tampa Bay, San Diego, the Dodgers, the Yankees, the Reds, the Royals, the Diamondbacks are sort of like in their own category. The Rays, the Yankees, the Diamondbacks, and the Dodgers are sort of like thought of in their own category, and the Padres too, where it's like these teams care about having people in person watching baseball games and making those evaluations. On the other side of things, the Braves, the Nats, the Astros, the Orioles, and now the Marlins seem to be prioritizing watching. It's not like they're not evaluating these pro level players, these prospects, these minor leaguers. They're just doing that via video, via data, behind a desk at the office. And the reason I think that that is bad is that there is no reason to not do both except for money. I understand that if you want to reallocate resources and you're kind of hamstrung by what you can spend from ownership, that it makes sense to, like, pro scouting, there's a lot of travel, there's a lot of expenses, it's, you know, it's a cost. Cutting that cost for cost cutting's sake feels short-sighted and is regrettable. And the reason, after this long-winded argument, the reason I think it's bad is it removes the soul from the sport. It removes like the essence, like baseball is about watching baseball in person. Is the delta between watching video and going through the data and watching in person like enormous? Not necessarily, but from my perspective as someone who wants to tell stories, the people that are there are the people with the stories. They're the people with the perspective, the people seeing things. They're on the road. They're living the baseball life in a way that is romantic, but also tangibly useful and real and insightful. And as we remove that, I understand that the game is changing and we should synthesize those perspectives with those of people that are behind a desk using data, who are maybe more objective. But it's like, why can't we do both? The Dodgers and the Yankees and like these other teams are doing both. And so I was bummed out this week to see that the Marlins sort of pulled the plug on that, seemingly in order to reallocate those funds elsewhere.
Yeah, I think that that's totally fair. We're going to be generally in favor of more information and not less. And you are sacrificing opportunities to acquire information, to learn more about people, which are the baseball players that are playing the baseball. And yeah, they're going to be missing out on that. But it is interesting. It is not perfect because, as you see, there are a lot of successful teams that are sending out tons of pro scouts. There are a lot of very teams that are not succeeding at all sending out pro scouts, and it's what you do with that information, of course, is really the difference making factor. All right, time for Ugla. You know where Jake's going. Do you want to go first?
We're going to the Vatican, baby. Back to Rome. Going back to Rome. Jordan is wearing his Rome Emperor's hat.
Oh, true.
Right now, I don't know if that was because of the Braves or because of the Pope.
No.
A couple weeks ago, we had the Pope hat giveaway, in which the Pope's fun pointy hat had a White Sox logo slapped onto it and was handed out to 40,000 people. We now know that one, at least one, has made its way to the frickin' Vatican. That's it. That's all I've got to say via Father Tom McCarthy, not the Phillies broadcaster. What are you saying?
Well, the takeaway here that I'm just realizing, yes, the photo of him with the hat is great. The second photo that the White Sox posted appears to have what I think is Ozzie Guillen's jersey framed and hung up, I guess, in Pope's office? Or
there's also like a nice box.
There's a very nice box that's clearly just now what's very apparent is that the White Sox, to their credit, have come up with essentially like Pope Leo branding that whenever they send him stuff or wherever they're doing giveaways, they have that. But I'm more noticing the fact that he seems to have started to decorate with some White Sox memorabilia.
Could you imagine 2 years ago me saying, hey, Jordan, a baseball team is going to take its free giveaway and they're going to bring it to the Pope? And you would have been like, all right, Jake, maybe time to take a nap.
And now it's like, well, yeah, why wouldn't they do that?
Of course.
Why haven't they done it already?
Yeah.
All right. My ugla.
Oh, wait. One other thing.
Oh, my goodness. Yep.
I love that the only way to get anything to the Pope in this regard is like you have to have someone bring it. Like you can't like ship it. You can't like DHL it. You have to have like someone needs to just go there to give it to him. It's very funny to me.
You do have to like know the right Catholic leader to like get it to him.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, it's great. We love it. Give us more Pope stuff. My ugla this week is similarly spiritual? This post was actually originally put online by @StuStyles, a Cardinals blogger, on February 28th, 2024. However, it did not really pop off until this past week for reasons that I have still not totally understood. However, what I'm talking about is a video of Sonny Gray as Troy Bolton in his high school's production of High School Musical at Smyrna High School in Tennessee in 2007. Sonny Gray was the leading role in this performance, and this two-minute video is him performing the iconic song, Get Your Head in the Game. When I watched this video, I mean, it's amazing in and of itself. It is very clearly Sonny Gray. This takes the Kyle Schwarber chorus performance in high school, a show choir performance in high school, however you would describe that. For those of you who are listening, know what I'm talking about. That's great. This is like a whole other level. And honestly, my real takeaway here is like, I kind of need more. The fact that this video exists tells me that there is Sonny Gray singing Breaking Free, you know? Like, it's not like he only performed this song. There is a whole video out there of so much more. Not that this is not plenty satisfying. It's just like, I kind of want the whole thing. So I don't know if Stu has access to the whole thing. I'm sure Smyrna High School does. But it's just amazing. It's also kind of a time warp, right? It's like, it makes you think like, wait a minute, how does this even make sense? But sure enough, the High School Musical came out in 2006. We were getting into middle school, I think, at that point. Sonny Gray is a few years older than us. So it all lines up, but it is a little bit like, wow, that's a long time ago. It's, you know, 20 years. But Smyrna, it's just amazing. It's an amazing video. And man, oh man.
Drop the tapes. Come on. Please. Let us see the whole thing.
Please.
Breaking Free. We need it. What I really want is in High School Musical 2, Get Your Head in the Game, not Get Your Head in the Game. High School Musical 2, I Can't Dance. Yes, you can. The baseball scene with Corbin Blue. I am thinking of them doing that, except instead of everyone having a nice time, Sonny Gray's throwing like 93 Mm-hmm. Like in the, it's like mm-hmm. blowing everyone out, like everyone's doors yeah. out.
I don't think there was ever any stage versions of High School Musical 2. Obviously, Sonny Gray by that point is, you know, at Vanderbilt and on his way to being a big leaguer, but just an amazing video. So thank you to Stu Stiles, who clearly uncovered this when Sonny Gray signed with the Cardinals, but now I got to enjoy it. So I'm in awe of this video. All right.
And Sonny Gray all season long, Jordan.
Yeah.
Sonny Gray this season has been getting his head in the game. Yeah. He has been great for the Boston Red Sox all season long.
He has been great.
Sorry, this weekend, there will be baseball once again. Go to the Game Time app. Our friends at Game Time, hop over there, buy some tickets. A lot of different options for you. Red Sox at Yankees, four games, doubleheader Saturday. It was a makeout from a rainout in June. We got D-backs, Giants, Marlins, Nats. Those are both four games. Dodgers, Tigers, where you're going to be. What else from this slate stands out for you?
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, I'll be there covering Dodgers, Tigers. You have some familial obligations this weekend. But if you were buying some tickets this weekend, which of these series would you want to see? Padres at Rays is like definition of weird interleague, even in the era of interleague isn't weird. That is definitely weird and certainly high
Jake
stakes.
Cronenworth. If there, the reason to go to Game Time, Jordan, is for the Jake Cronenworth revenge series.
That's true. So go check out the Trop. As we mentioned earlier, only so many opportunities left to watch baseball at the Trop. So I would say that is definitely the series I'm most intrigued by. Astros, Mets, Mariners, Blue Jays is always spicy. Those two teams hanging on for dear life in Toronto. So yeah, Game Time app. Go watch some ball. Thank you to
One
Jake.
Place.
Mace. Thank you. Oh, thank you to Jake Bowers. What else?
Thank you, Jake Bowers. Thank you to Ross Tudor. Thank you to Andrew Hartz. One place where the Game Time app does not help you is at the local high school on Wednesday night, where I played my first men's league baseball game in a long time. I won't get into the specifics. It is a 30 and up league. You have to be 35 to pitch, which is incredible. I was playing shortstop. I was the youngest guy on the team by maybe 15, 20-ish years. It was wonderful. Felt very welcomed. Had the jitters, Jordan. Had a lot of rust. Made an error on a ball coming in to start the game at short. High infield, didn't play it right. That's on me.
Okay? Making excuses, though, already.
I was not making the infield. I'm explaining. There's an explanation. We have to make the adjustment. It was a high infield, so we played it the rest of the day. Okay.
But I see.
We bounced back, second at bat. You know, fastball in on the hands, 66, 67 miles an hour. We turn on that bad boy. We put it off the top of the wall for a little triple. That feeling. I mean, it's the best feeling in the world to hit a ball square. And then, you know, you got to let the legs work. Had a lovely time. Good to be back out. Next game on Wednesday. It's good to be on the field.
All right. We will keep getting those updates. Jake, varsity baseball update. Throwback date, for date, the OG Barbacast listeners date. Right there. Thank you all for listening. Enjoy the weekend, and we'll talk to you on Monday. See ya.